Resources will come to order. First bill on the agenda is Senate File 3386. We could come to order. We'll hear from Senator Sparks first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to be in front of you today on Senate File 3386. Before we get going, Mr. Chair, I do have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, that would put the bill in the shape the author would prefer.
Senator Sparks, we don't have a quorum yet, so if you want to explain it, that's fine. Otherwise, if it's essential to your discussion, why don't you go ahead and do that?
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, last year we appeared in front of this committee asking the legislator to instruct the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to call together all the stakeholders interested, involved, and affected by the licensing of individual septic system. The committee and the legislator responded and passed the bill. The task force met a number of times. The report was due on February 15, 2008 of this year, and due to committee deadlines, we could not wait any longer. Senate File 3386 would resolve the licensing of individual septic system licensing for systems up to 10,000 gallons per day. With me today are two members of MOWA, the Minnesota On-Site Water Wastewater Association, and also members of the MPCA Task Force. First, we'll hear from the testifiers, Mr. Chair, if that's okay with you. I have with me today Mr. Eric Larson and also Ron Jasperson. I would turn over to them at this time.
Is someone going to explain what the bill does?
You guys, you'll go ahead and have it, Chair.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. Great. Shall I?
Yep.
What the bill does is establish that...
If you wouldn't mind introducing yourself for the
record.
Excuse me.
My name is Eric Larson. I live in Malacca, Minnesota. I'm a representative on the board of directors for MOWA. And I was also served on the stakeholders committee that operated over the past year. Since 1996, the rule and the law have allowed people with training under 115.56 the ability to design septic systems up to 10,000 gallons of daily flow. As the 7080, the Minnesota septic rule, has been going through revision, developing new chapters, advanced training for some of the larger, more complex systems, and we developed a chapter 7081, which starts identifying that in greater detail. It did bring to the fore again that there is a conflict with older language, 336, if I have my number.
326.
Which identifies engineering as requiring an engineering license, and basically if you do math, you're doing engineering. That's the layman's interpretation, perhaps. So in any case, what we asked last year is for legislation to clarify based on the belief that the intent of 115 was that that training would supersede or would, in fact, be the training required and necessary for these individual sewage treatment septic systems. And this just codifies that.
Okay.
There. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Eric Larson. My company is Septic Check Incorporated, based out of Malacca. We have built our business designing, installing, and operating specialized septic systems for difficult sites, such as lake lots with restricted space, churches and church camps, and resorts with widely fluctuating flows, and high-strength kitchenways for rural businesses. Our industry has been moving ahead, searching out innovative technologies to tackle these issues and protect the groundwater. Engineered technologies include advanced aerobic treatment, membrane treatment, sand and peat filters, fabric trickling filters, time dose control panels to manage flow, and remote sensing for distant operation. Do we work with soil scientists? Do we work with engineers? Yes, commonly. We bring them to our jobs regularly. We are part of a new generation of designated registered professionals, and by the way, our conference is currently on, our MOWA conference, which is why we're not dressed a little fancier today. We found this out that we're going to be hearing just yesterday afternoon.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, what is, you said MOWA, I keep trying to figure it out in my mind, and then I'm not listening to what you're saying. So what does that mean?
Madam Senator, it's the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association, MOWA.
Thank you.
I apologize. And we were informed yesterday by agency officials that were presenting changes in the ordinance, et cetera, going on for this year that we're now going to be referred to as designated certified individuals and not professionals. And reserving that. Since 1996, law and rule have allowed us to design systems up to 10,000 gallons per day. University Extension has trained us. Our trade organization, which includes county regulators, extension educators, independent business people, manufacturers, and engineers, have partnered with and supported the MPCA and University of Minnesota Extension in developing this industry. I have served on a state and national committees to develop standards, methods for design, maintenance, installation, and operating on such systems. We and others have built businesses around this work and actually created this industry. We agree that the new advanced training and licensing is important and that soil scientists and engineers need to be utilized in some circumstances. Now, however, engineers within the PCA intend to require engineers on all systems over 5,000 gallons per day and many down to 2,500 gallons per day, regardless of the simplicity of those systems. Let me be very clear that this market has always been open to the engineering community. It's never been excluded. They now want it to be exclusively theirs. I and others volunteered to serve on the committee that you, the legislature, instructed PCA to form. We received the MPCA draft report of the committee's work and wrote an extensive dissent to it. The final report has not been issued, and it was due the 15th of last month. My business is growing. We provide living wage jobs in rural Minnesota. And we protect our lakes, our rivers, and our drinking water. We provide economical solutions for treating wastewater in our communities. The needs of our customers are urgent, and today we do not know that we can do this work beyond 2010. We need your help. Please support this legislation. Thank you.
Any questions for the witness? Seeing none, we can go to the next witness, Senator Sparks.
My name is Ronald Jasperson. I come from Wilmer, Minnesota. I own a precast concrete plant in Wilmer, providing products of all kinds to the wastewater industry. I'm the current past president of MOWA, Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Treatment Association. We represent pretty much all of the suppliers, designers, installers, maintainers, service providers, engineers, county regulators. We recently revamped the organization to be more inclusive of everybody that provides to the industry. The legislation is basically trying to do two things for us. Where we added or provide service, that's a new license that's been developed within the agency. MOWA has been very active in working with the agency in developing these new rules and these new licenses. And then it specifies in here that the license for 115 would allow that license holder to work on any system up to 10,000 gallons a day. And on the back, it also does the housekeeping and puts in this new license category for service provider and reiterates that no other professional license would be required. Any reasonable citizen reading MS 115.56 will conclude that the intent of this statute is to develop a license to establish a business and do the work of designing subsurface sewage treatment systems. This license applies equally to on-site professionals who are not board licensed professionals, as well as board licensed professionals. Given the intent of the statute to license the non-board licensed professional, Subdivision 2C compels the agency to ensure that training exists to whatever level they write the rule governing the SSTS industry. SSTS industry stands for the subsurface treatment industry or subsurface sewage treatment systems. That training qualifies all license holders, the non-board licensed professional as well as the board licensed professional, to the same level of competency regarding the design of the subsurface sewage treatment systems to satisfy that rule. Subdivision 2C is where we added in the AN design guidance. It's not specific on the training. It says the commissioner in conjunction with the University of Minnesota or another higher education shall ensure adequate training exists. And because the new rules and the proposals from the agency are quite dependent on the design guidance, we feel it's necessary that they be instructed by statute to develop that design guidance. Until now, the agency has been true to the intent of MS 115-56 and established Rule 7080, which governs systems up to 10,000 gallons a day. The agency has ensured adequate training and has issued licenses to non-board licensed professionals and board licensed professionals as well. The non-board licensed professionals license holders have been designing the SSTS systems between 5 and 10,000 gallons per day. These license holders have built businesses that design, install, and operate these systems that provide the citizens an economical solution to their wastewater problems. When 7081, the new rule that just was recorded in February, began to take shape and become more defined, that was in mid to late 2006, rumors began to circulate throughout the industry that the professional engineering community had determined that the work in 7081, the new code, will be outside the engineering exemption table, and that work will need to be done by professional engineers regardless of the MS 115-56 license. As MAWA began to investigate the rumors, we found that many professional engineers within the Municipal Wastewater Division of the agency claimed that design work falls within the definition of engineering in Minnesota Statute 326, regardless of the qualifications or experience of that 115 license holder. Prior to 2006, the on-site division was... The on-site wastewater division in the agency was a little more autonomous than they are now. They've been that somehow the agency has merged the two divisions and they're more subject to the municipal wastewater division. It needs to be stressed that the MAWA members and the designers do not object to developing a team to help with site assessment and some aspects of the designs when the project or the site requires it. Many on-site designers already hire professional soil scientists or geologists to do site assessments for aquifer recognition, potential surface water impacts, groundwater mounding, and soil acceptance rates. What MAWA does object to is the mandated team building in all circumstances, regardless of simplicity. 1994, the legislature passed 115-56 to create the license for designers of the on-site systems who are not board licensed professionals. Prior to 1994, virtually all on-site wastewater systems were designed by practitioners without licenses or mandatory minimum standards of training. The board licensed professionals, engineers, had totally ignored this field of designing systems. Prior to 1996, the licensing of on-site professionals, there was no required training or designing on-site systems. The university developed a voluntary certification program for individuals who were designing and installing the systems. The board licensed professional engineering community had no interest in designing these systems. It appeared the lack of financial returns outweighed the potential environmental or public health impact of these systems. It's MAWA's position that the current MPCA proposals grant a competitive advantage to board-licensed professional engineers over the non-board-licensed professional designer by unnecessarily mandating the sharing of the design responsibilities. All the on-site professionals are asking for is the right to compete for the work on a fair and level field of competition. MS 115.56 guaranteed that in 1994, and the Rule 7080 set the ceiling at 10,000 gallons per day. The non-board licensed professional designers have proven the value of these systems and developed that market. We do not wish to block the board licensed professional industry in any way. If their training is as superior as they would like us to believe it is, they should be able to win the work on an open field of competition based on the merits of their work and not force us to share it with them. The business revenue to a design install firm is not just the design $10,000 to $20,000 fee for a system in this category. I think we need to recognize that we're talking about a very few number of systems here that does have a major impact on our industry and on the citizens of the state of Minnesota. Probably less than a half of a percent of the design work is in this category that we're discussing. But because of the size of those systems, we're probably talking in the 10 to 20% of the design revenue dollars that are in the marketplace. That can be a major impact to our small industry. A design build firm, which the majority of our members and the people currently doing these are design build package firms, instead of the $10,000 to $20,000 fee, it's $100,000 to $200,000 for the whole package fee. And if you're a small firm doing $1 million in gross sales, one 7,000-gallon-a-day system for $200,000 is a major business impact. To the citizen and the economics, whether they be publicly financed or privately financed, the impact is major. Recently constructed projects where the non-board licensed design build firms were allowed to compete with the board licensed designers for systems between 5,000 and 10,000 gallons demonstrate the difference in design concepts and approaches between the two. In 2003, Camp Onamia in northern Minnesota was told to bring their wastewater treatment into compliance. The local government unit told them that it's a large project, so they will likely need a professional engineer. The construction estimate was $750,000. As the camp talked about closing, the local on-site design build firm calculated the flows at just over 6,000 gallons a day. He designed and built that system for $189,000. The camp is still operational instead of closing. This is a case where the local government had overestimated that size and pretty much excluded the smaller on-site designer. In 2006, the town of Teopi in southeastern Minnesota, to address their straight pipe systems, had contacted a local on-site design build firm for an estimate to build individual systems for each of the 22 homes. The original estimate was $12,000 to $15,000 per home. The project qualified for public funds. The MPCA determined that the funding source mandated a professional engineer to do the design or at least review the design. The final cost of construction was just over $24,400 per home, which is greater than the value of some of the homes in that village. The original design install firm did not get the design or the install. In 1999, a system for 25 homes in central Minnesota, four engineering firms had estimated design fees between $35,000 and $50,000 to design a cluster system for 9,800 gallons a day. Construction costs were estimated at over $475,000. The system was designed and built for less than $150,000. The historical effect of Statute 115 is that the non-board licensed professionals have built businesses designing systems between 5 and 10,000 gallons. Rural Minnesota has come to depend on those designers for cost-effective solutions to their wastewater problems and to protect the environment. If the on-site industry is to continue to provide an effective solution to rural wastewater issues and provide cost-effective alternatives to professionally engineered systems, we need to have statutory assurance that the agency ensures that reasonable design guidance exists to the full extent of proven technology. For the non-board licensed professionals. It needs to be clear to both the agency and the board that governs the professional licensing that as of January 1, 1996, the definition of engineering, the activities of engineering, no longer applies to the activities of designing subsurface sewage treatment systems under 10,000 gallons a day. This committee is charged with protecting the environment. We need this legislation to protect a sufficient workforce to do the work protecting the environment from unnecessary litigation due to the definition of engineering. The members of this committee, as members of the legislature in Minnesota, are charged with maintaining a fair and level field of competition upon which all who are qualified, engineer or non-engineer, can compete for this work. Protect the environment by saying that anyone who meets or exceeds the qualifications set forth by Rule Chapter 7080, and now it's Chapter 7080 through 7083, or the proposed Rule 7081, would be legally licensed to design, install, maintain, inspect, or provide surface to a subsurface wastewater treatment system in the state of Minnesota up to 10,000 gallons per day.
We should probably start drawing our conclusions.
I'm done. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
Perfect time.
Questions for the witnesses? Senator Sparks, you have anyone else?
No, Mr. Chair.
All right. The next person I have on the witness list is Jerry Ritter.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jerome Allen Ritter. I'm the chair of the Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design. I'm not a professional engineer. I'm an architect, and I'm here not to lobby or to... I'd just like to add a couple of comments. The reason that our board exists and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency exists is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the citizens of this state. Last year, there was legislation passed that permitted the 10,000 gallon per day exemption and also mandated that that the Minnesota Pollution Control study this and come back with a legislative report. I recognize that that report has not been received, but this legislation is premature and that it passes by that very comprehensive effort by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to bring all the stakeholders together. During this past year, 36 individuals representing 18 different stakeholders and interested parties met several times to develop proposed rules for, excuse me, not proposed rules, but a proposed response to the earlier legislation. We think that I and our board believes that much of the information contained in that report would very much inform how this legislation proceeds. Again, we believe that although this might be the final document that proceeds from that recommendations, we believe that there's other considerations that need to be taken into account. Concerns about whether municipalities have any standing in regard to the proposed legislation. Concerns about whether 10,000 gallons is the appropriate technical appropriate limit or whether there are other considerations such as the source of the wastewater or the configuration of the wastewater or the soils condition under which the wastewater is being discharged. So we believe that this legislation, again, is premature and should await a more logical and technical approach to determining what the exact conditions of allowing SSTS systems.
Questions for the witness? Thank you. And the next person I have is Ted Field. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ted Field. I'm a professional engineer, and I'm here today as a representative of the American Council of Engineering Companies. I think you need to be reminded that 10,000 gallons per day is the flow that you would equate to a community of 40 to 50 homes. So we're not talking about individual sewage treatment systems here, but communities. So I'd say that this bill is not about competition so much as it's about affecting the installation of public infrastructure. And with that, we're talking about protecting public health and safety. We're not opposed to the requirement that systems of this certain technology require a special PCA license that requires an understanding of the treatment technologies involved. But as public infrastructure projects, the designers require also expertise in broader areas such as hydraulics, and pumping, electrical and structural issues. There will be collection systems involved with these systems that involve land acquisitions, easement acquisitions, right-of-way issues, those kind of things, the kind of things that you associate with public infrastructure. The wastewater systems are that we're talking about are prone to the infiltration of clear water, and these need to be quantified carefully. The owners of these systems are going to need to have cost recovery systems calculated, and also we're going to have to go through bidding processes. In short, what I'm saying is projects of this type, as public infrastructure projects, are the types of projects that engineers are trained to do and are experienced to do. You've heard about this report, or rather the bill that was heard last year that ended up with a recommendation that it be modified and that MPCA convene a group of stakeholders, including the Minnesota wastewater operators, members of the engineering community, University of Minnesota, Pollution Control Agency, soil scientists, and geologists. And that group has produced the report that you heard about today that is presently ready in a draft form and is very shortly would be delivered to the legislature for consideration. The recommendation, one of the recommendations that has come out of that stakeholders group, which, I, as you can see, includes a broad variety of backgrounds and expertise, is that systems above 5,000 gallons per day, in addition to requiring this special license, also require the involvement of a professional engineer for the reasons that I've cited today. So what I would encourage you to do is to table this bill until you've had a chance to review that report and ask questions about that report. Because I think it has great bearing on your decision here today. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for the witness? 10,000 gallons is 40 or 50 homes?
Yes, it is. A general rule of thumb is a household will generate anywhere between 200 to 250 gallons per day. But obviously, that varies on the number of occupants and so forth, but as a rule of thumb.
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry that I was late, but I was just curious what your intention is with this bill. Is it going to be voted on today or laid over? Or,
does this bill have to go to any other committees?
Do I know of?
It'll be laid over for possible inclusion. Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. I've heard twice from the testimony about a committee that was put together and a report coming out. Is that something we should know about, or is that something we're going to know about?
Hopefully. If there's no other questions for the witness, we'll ask PCA to approach.
Oh.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Thorvig, Municipal Division Director at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I do want to apologize that we did not deliver the report by February 15th. We have delivered it today, however. So, Senators, you should all have a copy. The letter is addressed to the chair, and the report is attached behind the letter. In 2004, the Pollution Control Agency embarked on updating its septic system rules. And so the rules had been adopted in 1992. There were many changes, and so we developed, we started to update the rules. The new rules were just adopted in January of 2008. So we underwent a four-year process to develop and work with stakeholders in coming up with the new rules. During that process, we actually identified a conflict in statutes. The statutes that govern our septic systems, 115, required the agency to license the professionals that design, install, and operate wastewater septic systems. In Chapter 326 of Minnesota statutes, that governs the Board of Architect, Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape Architect, Geoscience, and Interior Design. Quite a name. And we actually found, as we were doing these rules, that that septic systems would require also to be certified by professional engineers and geoscientists as well. And so when we found that, we actually got together, a small group, and discussed it, and we couldn't come to a resolution. So during the session last year, the legislature took two actions. One was to put language in statute with a sunset date of 2010 that said, for now, any septic system required under the statute up to 10,000 gallons per day only needs an MPCA licensed professional to design it. And then the other piece, the legislature asked the agency to convene a stakeholder group of all the stakeholders involved on both sides of the issue to see if we could come up with a compromise position and to write a report with a recommendation to you. So we held, we convened the stakeholder group. The legislature laid out in statute who all should participate. We pulled the stakeholder group together. We met, I think, six times between August and December. We could not reach a compromise. And so based, though, on the discussion, the Pollution Control Agency has written this report, and we're offering a compromise position. Right now, under our current programs, the Pollution Control Agency issues permits to big septic systems that serve communities of 10,000 gallons per day and larger. We require, when we issue those permits, that professional engineers and professional geoscientists get involved and sign off on those projects. We know, talking to other states, that most other states require the same kind of thing in the 2,500 to 5,000 gallon per day range. We don't have a lot of good information on why that is. So we don't have a real sound scientific basis, and we were hoping that we could get people together and just agree on what that number should be. Let me be clear that the Pollution Control Agency believes that we need the septic system designers, the ones we license, to be involved in the design of all septic systems whether it's an individual home up to 10,000 gallons per day. So that's not the issue. The issue is whether, in addition to those licensed designers, we also need professional engineers and some professional geoscientists on the larger of these septic systems. 5,000 to 10,000 gallons per day is, again, 16 homes up to 30 or 40 homes. So we're talking about clusters of homes and small communities here in that 5,000 to 10,000. What we're proposing in our report is a two-phase process. The first phase is to actually try a pilot for the next 2 years where there's a team approach, where we do at the 5,000 and above level, we do have the designers, the licensed designers, the professional engineers, and the geoscientists working to design these systems. We also, as part of our new rules, we have to develop guidance on the design so that the university knows what they need to do for training so we can license people. So between those two things, we will have a lot of information in 2 years to be able to come to the legislature and hopefully make a sound recommendation on this issue. The current law allows the septic system designers to continue to do the work they've always done until a sunset date of 2010. So we think that leaving the sunset date in right now is not affecting the septic systems. It will be a prod to all of us that we have to come back and address this issue in 2010, and we would like to work with all these professionals on both sides of the issue over the next 2 years to see if we can come up with a solution. I just want to give you a couple of four examples. In Iowa, for example, they require professional engineers and geoscientists at 1,500 gallons per day and above. In Wisconsin, they require professional engineers and geoscientists at 2,500 gallons per day and above. We would like to test at the 5,000 gallon per day and above for the next 2 years and then come back and address this issue. So the other thing that is in this bill is there is a provision that local governments can be more restrictive. So if a county or a city that has a septic system ordinance, if they feel that for their county or their jurisdiction that they want to have professional engineers and professional geoscientists involved in the design of these systems, they currently have the authority to do that. And even with this change, we're assuming that Senator Sparks did not intend to take away that local authority to require the professional engineers and geoscientists. And so we're hoping that will be clear if the legislature does decide to act to remove the sunset date. That's my testimony.
How common is it for a locality to have rules stricter than state law?
Senator, I'm going to have to apologize. I'm testifying here, but I'm not the expert in this area. My folks are actually up in Brainerd at the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association conference. So what I know is that some do and some don't. In fact, I was just talking to Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities, and he was telling me that the city of Rochester, for example, does require professional engineers and geoscientists at the lower level, more restrictive than the PCA. So I know that some do and some don't.
Mr. Chair, may I address that question?
Go ahead.
As part of our information gathering last year prior to legislation introduction, we did do surveys of counties all around the state, and of the counties that have significant septic system applications, the majority, I don't remember the number, but I believe is on the order of 65 or 70% support the 10,000 gallon limit. My firm has worked in well over 40 different jurisdictions, so some cities, townships, and mostly counties. We work the whole northern part of the state. And of those, we have a handful that are more restrictive.
And then you said that PCA supports these individual professionals being involved with designing septic systems along with the engineers. And then
You indicated that the compromise was to use a team approach as a pilot. What's the difference between what you're proposing now and current practice?
The current practice is that it's really up to the local jurisdictions and the professional septic system designers on when they call in the professional engineers and geoscientists. And ours would be more of a statewide approach. Should professional engineers and geoscientists as a practice be involved in the designs of systems that are 8,000 gallons? Right now they're involved in 10,000 gallons per day and above. Should they be involved in 8,000 gallon per day systems, 7,500 gallon per day systems, and we're starting at 5,000 gallon per day systems as the pilot, and see how that team approach goes along with our development of the guidance and the curriculum for our new rules and the new designs. And then 2 years from now, you know, we've tried a couple of different fashions to reach compromise, and we haven't been able to. We think that once we try some things and gain more information, we'll hopefully find a path forward on this issue.
What percentage of the septic systems are over 10,000?
Over 5,000, about 99% of the septic systems are the smaller, under 5,000 gallons. About 1% are over the 5,000 gallons. They tend to be the larger, so they represent about 5% of the wastewater treated by septics, but they're a small percentage of the business.
Okay. Senator Sparks, your witnesses, you're certainly not expected to respond to this report, but if you have any thoughts, feel free
to offer
them.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank you for hearing the bill today. I want to thank the Pollution Control Agency for coming up with this report. And I think in Mr. Jasperson's earlier testimony, you found out exactly why I'm here. I do represent the city of Teopi, 22 homes in southeastern Minnesota. And I think that we've worked with the PFA. We got them involved. I think you heard those 22 homes. Initially, they had went through some engineering study, and the cost of those local members were going to be between $12,000 and $15,000. You know, I thought I was doing him a favor. I wrote a letter on his behalf. The PFA agreed to do it, and the price of that jumped to $24,000. Mayor Kiefer, at the end of the day, said he wished we would even got the state involved. And so I think, I don't know if the PFA is here today. I don't want to certainly talk derogatory towards them, but I do know in their defense they said that this is a new program, but there's things that they think we can do better. And I think certainly in a smaller communities, when cost is a real issue with these, you know, we have some, I know many of you probably saw the Star Tribune article about a small community that I represent as well, Nickelville, which has just a handful of homes, and the straight pipes are dumping right in there. They're ranked on the PFA list right now of 100. I think they're number 3 on their list. To give you some perspective, and you guys know this certainly on the Environment Committee, at our current level of bonding, I think anything from that score to 45 and higher would try to be replaced. So what we're just trying to look for is some kind of a compromise. Again, I appreciate the PCA moving forward, and hopefully we can try to come to some kind of a resolution. And certainly the members of this committee will try to have to wrestle with that number, where it's supposed to be at 10,000, 75, or 5,000. I guess I'll have to let you guys kind of wrestle with that.
MOA folks, what is your response so far?
Well, I want to make two responses to what Ms. Thorvig just presented. And referring to Iowa at 1,500 gallons requiring engineers, in Wisconsin at 2,500, Wisconsin's septic code is part of their plumbing code. And Iowa is just developing a septic code starting about 3 years ago. They're trying to copy much what Minnesota has. Minnesota has developed a program that's highly respected around the nation. Other, and I know this because I serve on committees involving University of North Carolina, Texas A&M, Washington Stock Septic Association, so all over the nation. And people come here to see what it is that we're doing. We've got a tremendously good program here, and it's very well developed. So that's one item. We do have more of a code to work with. We have a significant number of professionals trained like me who do not have the board license credentials who are highly sophisticated, if I might toot my own horn, in finding resolutions to these problems. You will see when we well, you won't see in here, but when we went through the hearings, this year long of meetings, that we kept asking for data to be brought in. There's significant. If you go to the PFA or to the USRDA, you'll find there's a high percentage of failure rates in engineered systems over 10,000 gallons per day. We could not produce data on systems between 2,500 and 10,000 gallons in our hearings. And they'll say right in there, it's their feeling, it's their expectation. It's not based on facts. It's based on presumptions. And if we get out and do a thorough analysis of the work that's been being done in this state for quite a period of time, you're going to find an extremely high rate of compliance in those systems. So the issue really does appear to be something other than that.
Thank you. What's the on that the percentage issue? What's the nub of the issue here? We're talking about, you know, why are we arguing over 1% of the systems and 5% of the wastewater.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, and thank you for asking that question, because that came up repeatedly, and it was actually some of the representatives of the ALE board said that repeatedly during the, you know, we're talking about such a small percent of the sales. Why is it such a big issue? And it's a large percent of the revenue. What happens, because we worked over 12 different engineering firms, our firm has, so it's a world we live in all the time. And what happens is that there is a real transition and how the transaction goes. And let's say, for instance, we're working with a church camp. They've got a very sensitive site. They've got an old-growth maple basswood forest, and they're critically concerned about maintaining the character of the camp. And this is a very typical situation. Or the resorts. I'm sorry that Senator Sexhouse left because we worked on a resort up in his territory. That's exactly their situation. And so we come in with a very creative system that protects the groundwater, addresses groundwater mounting, nitrogen, phosphorus, all the issues that are being covered here. And we do it for a fraction of the price it would have been, so he was able to proceed with it. But what's happening is that during that process, we're engaged with a customer for the whole process. And when we get involved with engineering firms, there's a transition. There's a disconnect. You know, certainly tempo changes. But and it's tough to put into words, as though there's an abstraction that since we know this is what it's got to be, and this is the end of the conversation. We found that isn't necessarily the way it has to be. So the relationship with the customer changes dramatically, and we certainly end up seeing significantly more cost than is necessary for a 40-year system. It's not that it's unnecessary but in all cases, but to design a system that's going to last 40 years often requires less structure.
Resort is typically how many gallons?
Varies widely. A lot of the small resorts, a typical number we'll see is maybe 12, the older style, maybe 12 cabins that they're debating whether they can keep at a resort or if they have to be forced by current economic conditions, break it up and sell it as 12 individual parcels. So that's a very common situation. And on that, if they're small cabins, you're talking a flow of probably 300 gallons a cabin, so 3,600 gallons. If you look at the, that'd be small. If you look at the report here, and I have, and just glancing at it here, I don't see if there's differences to the draft. I didn't read it closely enough to see that. But one of the recommendations is that starting at 2,500 gallons, if there's a complex collection such as a pressure collection, then engineering will or may be needed. I'm not sure. And they don't identify complex. But believe me, we work with those types of systems all the time. We get engineer review, but the engineer is done by vendors who are not necessarily members of the board. They might be reviewed by an engineer who sits in Washington as a vendor or sits in Missouri. But we get engineer review on this, but it's not going to qualify anymore because they need to get stamped by a person with a Minnesota license. So these are not complex to us because we deal with them all the time. And on the large side, we're currently installing a septic system for resort, and it's 45,000 gallons per day. It's one of the larger resorts in the state, obviously an engineered system start to finish. So it's a huge range in there. Of the smaller resorts, we're talking 3,500 to 6,500 is a very common range for daily flow, if that makes sense to you, sir.
So do we need to address the threshold maybe?
Excuse me, address?
Do we need to address the threshold, not 10,000, but 5,000?
Well, and what happened?
Capture the vast majority of these systems?
That would be one consideration. We would love to have had that conversation with the agency over the past year. And to be clear, of the members that were sat on that stakeholders committee, 70% or so are members of the board licensed professional community. We did, in the course of that hearing, and you're going to see that if you have a chance to read this report, we did generate a matrix. And the matrix would, it overlaid complexity and size and all the various categories like nitrogen and phosphorus and these things that are critically important to our groundwater. And where, if you've got certain sensitive soils and things, we generated a matrix. At this level, you bring in a soil scientist, at this one a geo, at this one a professional engineer, et cetera. And that matrix would have allowed, in some instances, a person with my licensure to work all the way to 10,000 gallons. And that was agreed to on three different occasions by consensus by the committee. And when it became clear that that's where we were going, then the agency brought in a proposal that limited it to 5,000 gallons. And they do say in here that it was their proposal. They're straightforward about that. That was not where the thing had gone. Now, the board licensed professionals were quick to endorse it for the most part because they would rather have had it at the lower level. But that was the nature of how the year turned.
All right. Further questions? Ms. Thorvig, the report is dated February 15th. No one from the stakeholder group has seen this report since in the last 3 weeks or even knew that it was coming?
Mr. Chair, the stakeholders all received the draft report. And it was drafted by our staff. The edits that were done were editorial kinds of changes through our system. So the stakeholders have all seen the report.
When did they see it?
Well, it's been 3 weeks, probably. I think. Do we have 10 days to respond, Ron, when it came out? 8 days? We had to have our responses in on the 6th, I believe.
Okay.
February 4th is what our response was.
So there was knowledge of the contents of this report. All right.
All right. We just didn't know if it had changed in the interim.
All right. Okay. Sir, did you have something burning that you needed to add?
Just clarifying the date.
All right. Okay. All right, Senator Sparks, so last word.
Mr. Chair, again, just thank you for listening to this. I know it's a very important issue, and we want to make sure that we do the right thing. So I think it's good that we continue to work on this, and appreciate any efforts that you can do to help me in that regard.
All right. We have a quorum on the A1. This is the author's amendment. Senator Scogin will move the A1.
So moved.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senate file 3386 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. I presume the parties will be talking between now and then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will certainly encourage them to do just that.
Thank you. All right. Senator Sparks, would you like to, excuse me, Senator Scogin, would you like to take the gavel?
I would.
Committee members, we're going to turn our attention to Senate File 3425, Game and Fish Provision Modification. Senator Chaudhry.
This is, the main Game and Fish proposal from the DNR. There are other Senate files around, but this is kind of the main one. And so I will have Mr. Bogus go through it with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You may have gotten a copy of a fact sheet that the department prepared on this bill, or it's being distributed right now. The fact sheet doesn't follow the sections of the bill exactly, and there's some items in the fact sheet that are in multiple sections of the bill, so I'll just try to walk you through the bill and point to where it
references
it.
For the record, our testimony comes from Ed Bogus, DNR.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry I didn't identify myself for the record. Section 1 of the bill, and there are also other portions of the bill that relate to clarifications on shelter licensing. As you may recall, a year ago, legislature exempted portable shelters from needing to be licensed, but there's been some confusion in what constitutes a portable shelter, and there are also other structures that may be placed on the ice besides fish houses or dark houses. And so we're creating a definition for shelter to include any structure set on the ice of state waters, whether it's a fish house, a dark house, or other shelter. And then later on in the bill, in sections 15, 16, 26, 27, and 28, are other elements where this definition comes into play and where we clarify that a shelter that's left unattended does not need to be licensed, but if it is left unattended, it does need to be licensed, and we think that would be a pretty straightforward way of making that distinction. Section 2 of the bill relates to making some clarifications of it's a technical part of rolling the turkey stamp fee into the turkey stamp license rather than having a separate turkey stamp, since there's only one license required. A turkey license is only valid for turkey hunting, and we've had a number of hunters who were inadvertently in violation because they had a turkey license and didn't have a turkey stamp. We would just propose in this bill to roll the stamp fee into the license fee, which is a $5 stamp. Just increase the license fee by $5 and then dedicate $5 of each license to the turkey stamp account. And so this, you'll find a number of references to this in the bill. It occurs in sections 2, 3, 5, 7, 12, 13, 14, 17, and 25. So because we're eliminating the actual stamp or stamp validation, there are going to be a number of references that occur. The next one is in section 3, where it also relates to the same issue, and it's the Game and Fish Oversight Committees, and rather than having a subcommittee to review the report on the turkey stamp, it would be to review the report on the Wild Turkey Management Account, which would be the money from the license fee. On the bottom of page 3 and moving on to page 4, there's a change for the pheasant stamp. Back before the 2002 Farm Bill, we worked with Pheasants Forever to get a provision that would allow personnel to be hired with pheasant stamp money to promote Farm Bill conservation programs. That language sunsets next year, and we have been pretty successful working with Pheasants Forever and Board of Water and Soil Resources in partnership on a Farm Bill assistance program where we jointly hire staff to market these Farm Bill programs, and we'd like to be able to continue to use pheasant stamp for that purpose. So we're just extending the sunset date on that personnel cost out of the pheasant stamp account. Section 5 is back to the turkey, rolling the turkey fee, stamp fee into the turkey license again. That would dedicate the money that would have come from the stamp now out of the license fee to the turkey stamp account. Section 6 on page 5 just adds another situation under which a person could get a refund for a license fee. The refunds are pretty well laid out in statute, but if a person in error purchases two identical licenses, we would refund, and we've done that, but we'd like the clear authorization to do that.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frederickson.
Chairman, Mr. Boggess. What would you do in a situation where, say, an individual bought a sportsman's license and then in addition bought a separate fishing license? Would they be eligible for a refund on the fishing license when they realized the error?
Mr. Chair and Senator Frederickson, this language would not allow that.
Okay.
It's a good point, though.
Sounds like we need to figure something out.
Yeah, we may need to think about that.
Delete identical.
Some language for that.
Just delete identical.
Senator Frederickson, did you have a follow-up?
Mr. Chairman, I was wondering if you might accomplish it, and Senator Chaudhry might consider this sometime along the line, just delete identical.
So that line 5.15 would say the licensee purchased two licenses for the same license season in error. Senator Chaudhry?
It would seem like it would help that issue. Just want to make sure we don't create any other issues.
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry and Frederickson, I think that might work, or if we said something like two licenses for the same purpose and season or something to that
effect. Mr. Knopf, did you want to weigh in?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to point out, if you look at on line 5.7, the commissioner may issue a refund, so the commissioner has discretion. If the commissioner doesn't feel that it's appropriate, then the commissioner doesn't have to do it.
With current language, you feel it maybe is covered?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just think that there's some discretion that if it says two licenses for the same license season, that's pretty clear. And they purchased them in error. That's something you have to show to the commissioner that it was purchased in error.
We agree.
Mr. Bogus, do we have people so giddy about using our natural environment that they just purchase licenses willy-nilly? Or?
Mr. Chair, they just get overcome with their enthusiasm. Sections, and that I think Mr. Knopf makes a good point. Still, it's discretionary, and we could make the if we delete the identical, then it would give us that discretion to
Mr.
decide.
Senator Fredrickson.
It's Senator Chaudhry's bill. Let him make the motion.
Go ahead and move it. Oh,
yeah. Mr. Chairman, on page 5, line 15, delete the word identical.
You hear the motion for the amendment? Questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Okay, moving on to Section 7. This is, again, related to the turkey stamp issue. And would delete the pictorial turkey stamp from the list of stamps provided after the purchase of a stamp validation, because we're no longer requiring a stamp validation, but it would continue to allow the pictorial turkey stamp. We would continue to hold a turkey stamp contest and produce a stamp and provide the stamp for the fee of $2. It would no longer be any sort of a licensing document, nor would the validation.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bogus, any idea,
Senator Chaudhry,
how many more turkey stamps are bought in addition to the actual license? Do stamp collectors, a sizable amount of stamp collectors,
Mr. Bogus,
still buy them?
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, some collectors do buy them, but we've found since we've gone to the self-adhesive stamp that it's less collectible than the old perforated type stamp. So I don't know how many that would be, or if we could even sort that out from our system.
Just curious.
We could, though, certainly produce a number for how many request the pictorial stamp, whether they're hunters or collectors. We know how many of the pictorial ones we mail out, so we could get that information. Sections 8 and 9 kind of go together. The idea here is to standardize the minimum age for big game hunting. Right now you have to be age 16 or possess a firearm safety certificate to hunt deer, which means basically age 12, but for moose and elk, you have to be age 16, period. And we would just have this revert back to the same rule as applies to deer. There's also a technical change on line 6.19 where we're deleting for any of the last five seasons, because since this was made a lifetime in 1991, more than five seasons have elapsed, so we no longer need that language. Section 10 eliminates the minimum age of prairie chicken hunting. It eliminates the firearm safety certificate requirement for prairie chicken hunting, which is the same basically as the minimum age requirement of 12. Section 11. We're trying to clarify. Last year, the legislature deleted the requirement that you had to live on the property on the 80 acres of agricultural land in order to receive a free landowner deer license. Question came up after the session whether that was intended to apply to non-residents. We didn't think the intent was to apply to a non-resident, so we're seeking clarification from the legislature the intent was to only apply that to a resident landowner. Section.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bogus, Why the age change on the prairie chicken license?
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, we just started a prairie chicken season, I don't remember exactly, but 5 years or so ago, and because it was a lottery drawing, we treated it more like a big game sort of a drawing. But since that time, the minimum age has been eliminated for turkey hunting. There never has been a minimum age for any other small game hunting, and we just don't have a good rationale to have a minimum age for prairie chicken hunting when we don't have it for turkeys or any other small game species.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bogus, you don't need a firearm safety certificate to hunt small game?
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, not if you're under age 12. There's a progression where before you can get a license to take a protected animal, you have to have a firearm safety certificate.
Mr. Bogus, but if you're under 12, you need a license?
Mr. Chair, for prairie chicken hunting, you would.
But not a gun safety certificate?
Well, and as the question's being asked, there may be another section of statute that still would require that for a person born after 1980. Maybe Mr. Knopf is already a step ahead of us here. But
I believe he's opened the book. Yeah.
I'm not sure this does quite what we thought it was doing as the question's being asked.
What was the intent?
The intent, Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, was to no longer have a minimum age for prairie chicken hunting. But we still have the section of statute, I don't remember exactly where it is, that says anyone born after January 1st of 1980 must have a firearm safety certificate to purchase a license to take a protected species. And I don't think we've done anything to that section of statute.
Mr. Knopf?
Doesn't that de facto create a minimum age of 12?
Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, it would.
That's why I was confused. I wasn't sure.
I understand the confusion.
Okay.
So, point well taken. We're going to have to take another look at this, I guess, to see if it really is even possible to do what we thought we were trying to do.
Mr. Knopf.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what Mr. Bogus is referring to is our general firearm safety certificate requirements. And it does say it's basically anybody born after December 31st, 1979, which is basically the same date, has to obtain a certificate before they can get a license. But it also does, we do have this under age 16, where a person under the age of 16 can possess a firearm when they're accompanied by a parent or guardian. And they can also do it without being accompanied as long as it's on land owned or occupied as the principal residence of the person or the person's parents. So they can hunt on their own property without having a license or if you're under age 16 on your own property. And you also can do it if you're just accompanied by a parent or guardian. If you're 14 or 15, you can also do it with a firearm safety certificate. But there are those exceptions to the general rule in the firearm safety and licensure for those children under age 16, as long as they're accompanied by a parent or on their own property. So this would allow those people to also get it. The way I read it, would allow those people to also get a turkey permit to either hunt with their parents or hunt on their own property if they don't have a firearm safety certificate, is the way I'm reading this. But you do have the prohibition on issuing a license, so it's kind of hard to,
right.
You know.
Mr. Chair and
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Knopf, I think the question in my mind is the fact that they need the license to hunt prairie chicken. They also need the license to hunt turkey, so we may have the same issue with both. And
yeah.
I think we may need to regroup on this one a little bit, see if we need to do something else. Yep. In addition to what we're doing here or rethink this provision, because I know there's exceptions if they're accompanied or if they're on their own property, exceptions from having the certificate if they're accompanied, or exceptions from having a license for small game if they're on their own property, but those exceptions don't apply to turkey or to prairie chicken. So
yep.
They still need that license, and I think that other statute would would require them to have a firearm safety to get that license if they were born since 1980. So I apologize for the confusion on this one. I think we probably need to do a little more work on it.
We'll work on it.
Mr. Bogus.
Okay. Moving on to...
I think it's a... It's,
Senator Schroeder?
It's revealing. I didn't know that you can take a 14-year-old out hunting without a firearm safety certificate. If you...
On your own property? No?
Or if they're with their parent.
If they're with, Mr. Chairman, if they're with their parent and no licensure is required.
No licensure
is required. It's on a small game license. Children under the age of 16 can hunt without a small game license. So, yes, you would be able to for general small game.
What about the firearm safety certificate? That you have to have.
Mr. Chairman, as long as they're accompanied by a parent, the way I read this, they don't have to have it if they're out with a parent or guardian. And they're under the age of 16 because they don't have to have they aren't required to purchase a small game license, and they, maybe Mr. Bogus could clear this up a little bit more.
Mr. Bogus.
That's the way I understand how it works.
Mr. Chair and committee, the 97A451 provides that a resident under the age of 16 may not obtain a small game license, but may take small game by firearms without a license if, and then there's a series of things, if they're age 14 or 15 and possess a firearm safety certificate, if they're age 13, possess a firearm safety certificate and are accompanied, or if they're age 13, 14, or 15, possess an apprentice hunter validation, which was a new option last year, and are accompanied by a parent or guardian who possesses a small game license, or age 12 or under and are accompanied. So once they hit age 13, they either need a firearm safety certificate or an apprentice hunter validation, and they have to be accompanied until they hit age 14. So it's a little bit confusing.
I think it would help if we regrouped, and might be some other ideas here that we need to simplify our rules.
Thank you, Senator Chaudhry. But did I just one more time, we're going to run it around the barn here. Did I just hear you say then that a 12-year-old accompanied by a parent doesn't need a firearm safety certificate?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. 12 and under.
12 and under.
It's not, but they do need to be accompanied.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bogus.
Okay, moving on to page 7, and we already talked about Section 11, trying to clarify whether your free landowner license applied to a resident or a non-resident. Section 12 deals with turkey and turkey licenses and stamps, and this is rolling that $5 fee from that used to be in the stamp into the license fee, and also on page 8, line 8.2, making a technical change to make it clear that that youth can also buy muzzleloader price licenses as one of the options. We've been doing this, but the law wasn't. Since these terms have been defined a few years ago in statute for the regular firearms and the muzzleloader season, the regular firearm season does not include the muzzleloader season, and so we just need this technical change in this section for residents, and also in the next section. We're doing the same thing in Section 13 for non-residents for both the turkey license fee and for the youth muzzleloader license. In Section 14 is another turkey stamp validation rolled into the license fee provision, where we're just eliminating the turkey stamp validation. Section 15 on page 9 comes back to the shelter. The definition of shelter being added to the statute, so we're just adding reference to so that any shelter that's left on the ice needs to be licensed. Section 16 is the same issue with shelters for non-residents. Section 17 again is This one's a little bit broader. It's getting at issuing fees for stamps and stamp validations. We've gotten rid of stamps as licensed documents now for all of the stamps that we've had out there. It used to be a validation was all you needed for a trout and salmon or a turkey stamp, but you needed the actual pictorial stamp signed for ducks and pheasants, and now validations are all that are required as a licensing document for those other stamps. And so we're just cleaning up some of the language here on issuance of those stamps, stamp validations.
Except for the federal waterfowl. When we say we, the state.
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, that's correct. The federal stamp is issued by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Minnesota was actually one of the pilot states to test an electronic federal stamp this year, but that's done through a different legal process than in state statute. So this only affects the state stamps.
It doesn't need to be in the bill, but can we get the commitment from the department to put that in the book? You know, you still need to buy the federal waterfowl stamp. I could easily see confusion.
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, we'll make that clear in the book. Page 10. At the top, it's just more of the cleanup on the stamp validation language. Section 18 is a change to allow a person, under current law, a person who's age 11 can take firearm safety. That's the first age at which they can take firearm safety and pass the course. So they can take the course, they can obtain the certificate, they can purchase a license that they're required to have firearm safety for, but neither the certificate nor the license are valid till the day they turn age 12. What this section of the bill is doing is saying that not only can they get the certificate at age 11, but they can hunt for the entire regular season, big game for the entire regular season for which the license is valid if they will reach age 12 during that calendar year. And because our big game seasons start in the fall, this would mean that they would have to be at least 11 years and 9 months, you know, by September, or 11 years and 8 months by September. And so that's kind of the youngest age that we're talking about here. And we've had situations where we've had a person who doesn't turn 12 till like the third day of the deer season, and they have to sit around until Monday while everybody else is out hunting. And so we think this just makes some common sense on if they're going to turn 11 that or 12 that fall, they'll all go ahead and use the license that they've purchased.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bogus,
Senator Chaudhry,
why just big game?
Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, if we extend it to turkeys, there are some issues with a younger age in April, potentially, where they're not turning age 12 until late in the year. Big game has been the major issue, so
I was thinking more of pheasant and waterfowl. Pheasant starts middle of October. Waterfowl, you know, beginning of October. There's a late season goose, isn't there?
Mr. Chair, for the small game, they don't need a license. But they may need the certificate, so I'm not sure if there's an issue for small game because they don't need a license at that age, although there is some legislation that would require them to get a free license. It's working its way along, so
let's think about it.
Take that under advisement.
Yeah.
Section 19, this actually goes along with another provision in the bill which relates to a proposal to require non-toxic shot on public lands in the agricultural zone of the state, and that's found in Section 24. And the idea here is that we put together a non-toxic shot advisory committee a few years ago to look at if there was a need to continue to phase out the use of lead shot that has been done for waterfowl hunting now for 15 years or so, and they made some recommendations. They couldn't come to consensus on too many recommendations. They did come to consensus on use of lead shot on managed dove fields. They felt should not be allowed, and we, by rule, required non-toxic shot on managed dove fields. They also agreed that there's a certain inevitability to complete ban on lead shot at some point. They couldn't agree whether it's within 10 years, 50 years, or 100 years, but they think it's coming. This was one of the recommendations to prohibit use of lead shot on public lands in the agricultural zone of the state, but it wasn't unanimous. However, if we did do it, they suggested a phase-in, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But if we do that, there's under current law for the small game hunting with blaze orange, there's an exception when hunting with non-toxic shot. And that the intent of that was to exempt a waterfowl hunter who happened to be walking back from the blind to the truck and might flush a pheasant from having to have switched to blaze orange from their waterfowl, because you're not required to wear blaze orange while waterfowl hunting, but you are for other small game. So this provision actually goes along with the non-toxic one that I'll talk about a little, you know, in more detail a little bit later. Section 20, this is a technical change. I think it's consistent with past practice. Ms. Watts is here from our enforcement division, but right now when we issue a disability permit for use of a crossbow to a person who's unable to draw a bow, a regular bow, I understand there are some devices that are available that allow you to hold a vertical bow at full draw. It locks the bow at full draw, and then it can be either triggered or released by hand. And my understanding is we've allowed those. If a person can use a crossbow, they can also use those bows. This would just make it explicitly clear in law that that's an allowable thing to do. Section 21. This one's a little bit confusing, but there's a longstanding statute that says that you can't have a firearm and a bow and arrow in possession at the same time while hunting big game. And there was an exception made a number of years ago now for bear hunting that would allow you to carry a firearm while you're hunting with archery. But because we don't have a separate archery season for any big game species except for deer, we think it makes sense to only apply this while you're deer hunting, that you can't have a gun and a bow at the same time. Because for moose and elk, you already can have a gun and a bow at the same time when bear hunting, and moose and elk are the other big game species, and we don't specify whether you use a gun or a bow. You could use a gun one day, a bow the next day, a gun in the morning, a bow in the afternoon. It's totally up to the hunter as long as they meet the minimum criteria. So the proposal here is just to not prohibit possession of a gun and a bow at the same time in the field except during the deer season. That's when you're taking deer by archery. Section 22 would extend to non-resident youth the same provision that applies to resident youth in a lottery deer area that allows them to take a deer of either sex without having to apply for and receive an antlerless permit. This has been the case for resident youth for a long time. There aren't that many non-resident youth. Last year we allowed non-resident youth to get a license at the resident fee, and we just think it makes sense to also allow them the same options for taking antlerless deer that resident youth have. Section 23. Last year, the baiting prohibition for deer was in rule, and last year it was put into statute. Part of the reason for that was to address an issue of a person being precluded from hunting if someone was baiting on adjacent property. What Section 23 is doing is rewriting what was passed last year to try to clarify some confusion that was created, and also in subdivision 4 to make it clear that if someone is on adjacent property with bait or feed and the person who's hunting had nothing to do with that, that they're not in violation of the baiting law if they're hunting there. And this has potential application both in the case that brought the issue to the legislature last year. There were two feuding neighbors, and one was intentionally placing feed near the property line of another property so that the neighbor couldn't hunt his property. But there also could be situations where it's inadvertent. There's someone feeding cattle or baiting, and might even be adjacent to public land. And we just want to make it clear that if the person isn't involved with it, they can't be charged with a violation of the baiting law. So we think this will clarify and also deal with what may have been an inadvertent loophole that was created last year. I'm going to move along fairly quickly here. The non-toxic shot, I think I've already talked about. The agricultural zone is described here. It's roughly that area south of 95 and west of highways 10 and 59. And the idea here is these public lands in the ag zone are areas that have a lot of wetlands. They're intermingled with federal lands that already require non-toxic shot on the WPAs, and they have for the last 8 years or so. Because there's a lot of pressure, there's a lot of deposition of shot on these lands, and this is consistent with a number of our surrounding states have also gone to non-toxic shot restrictions, including South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, on their public lands. Section 25 is another turkey stamp validation section. Section 26 goes back to the shelter. This was last year that exempted the portable shelters from licensing, and because all shelters are to some extent portables, nobody leaves them out year-round, we're proposing that if they're not attended, they need to be licensed, and we think that would be a clear-cut term and if it's really portable, because the canvas ones that are highly portable are not left unattended, or they tend to walk off. Section 28, again, deals with the shelter definition. It also deletes section that says that if you violate it, there's no penalty. And section 29 is related to shelters, but it's a different issue. It just says that shelters left on state public access. There's already laws on getting shelters off the ice. This just extends that to a state public access site more than 48 hours past the removal deadline from the ice.
Mr. Chair, members, I just wanted to editorialize a bit, not on what the proposal is, but just to mention that this is a result of a change we made last year to the finance bill in eliminating licenses, for the most part, for portable fish houses. And it was great for me. I think it was a lot of people appreciated it, but the issue didn't get vetted very well, and it was just kind of an amendment that came up in the Environment Finance Committee, and there's been quite a bit of discussion amongst the angling community about this change. Some that feel that they weren't consulted. Others that there was confusion, and others that the DNR wasn't consulted. So these are some of the things that are kind of leftover issues that were created when we did that. And so I just wanted to mention that just because it seemed like a good idea to remove the license, well, why wouldn't everyone like that? It still at the very least generated a good deal of conversation amongst the angling community.
Mr. Boggess?
Not that I am suggesting that you should care, but it might be a good idea. Mr. Chair, might be a good idea in the future.
Mr. Chair and members, there's a couple other provisions here. The Section 30 would extend the current limit of no more than one walleye larger than 20 inches and one northern pike larger than 30 inches daily to make that a possession limit, so it would not allow a person to accumulate multiple fish over multiple days that were larger than these sizes. And this is something that's been talked about for quite a few years. It's mainly aimed at to redistribute the harvest of some of those larger fish, maybe save some of those larger fish. Mr. Pyre's here if there's more questions on that. And then also Section 31 would direct the commissioner to amend the bag limit rules to establish a daily and possession limit of four walleye and sauger statewide. Currently it's six. Again, this is something that we want to get on the table for discussion. It's not a biological or management issue. It's more a distribution of the harvest issue and distributing harvest amongst more anglers or over a longer period of time. And it's been a subject of a lot of discussion, and we just thought it should have some discussion in this forum.
Mr. Bogus, does it also become an enforcement issue?
Mr. Chair, there's a number of the larger walleye lakes now have a limit of four. Certainly most of the lakes do not have a limit of four, but it would lead to more standardization to a small extent.
And this is the same limit. We're under the same limit at the moment, Mr. Chair, since the 1950s. And a lot has changed since then, particularly pressure and technology finding the fish. And I don't know if there are any studies, but maybe the DNR has studies on trends on the average size of fish caught over the 50s, over the last few decades.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Ron Pyre, DNR Fish and Wildlife. Senator Chaudhry's question, there have been some results of studies and through our creel surveys that would indicate the average size of a number of our major game fish species have declined, certainly since the 1960s. That was actually the fundamental reason we created the fishing roundtable, was to try to address that, the issue of declining average size, not to create trophy fisheries necessarily, but to put fish out there that would a balance between quantity and quality satisfy most anglers. So we certainly have seen in a number of species that decline size. Others, such as muskie, have kind of gone the other way.
Is that done scientifically or through a reporting process from the anglers, or how do you do that?
Mr. Chairman, the initial study was a scientific study done by a research biologist out of Detroit Lakes, and he looked at a number of entries to the Fuller bait tackle shop and could see the decline. So with the advent of some of the electronic database management, we do creel surveys on a number of waters every year around the state, and so we can see declining average sizes in creel over a period of time. So, for example, on Winnebagoish in the 60s, the average size of walleye was over 2 pounds, and now it's just over one.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Pyre, I have a question about the trophy fish, the 20-inch for walleye and the 30 for northerns. Suppose an angler catches a 29-inch walleye in May, takes it to the taxidermist to have it mounted for display, and in July catches another 29-inch walleye and has it in his possession. Is he breaking the law?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, enforcement might be a better source of that. I would not think so. I think when you do taxidermy on anything, whether it's deer or anything else, that's at that point in time would not be considered part of your possession limit, but I don't know specifically how enforcement.
Mr. Chairman, let me change the scenario. Suppose he just leaves the fish whole froze in his freezer until he catches the second fish. Takes them both to the taxidermist.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, in that case, if that individual would have two fish in possession that were over 20 inches, then that would be a violation.
Other questions for the witness? Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for point of interest, when you talk about the size of walleyes, is there any thought at all, besides reducing, which I think is a good idea, at least the folks I talked to think it's a good idea before, of a slot limit, minimal slot limit, would that do any good to bring the harvest up to a little better quality fish?
Mr. Pryor.
Chairman, Senator Ingebretson, a statewide slot limit is more difficult to implement just because growth rates vary so much. A fish might get to a pound on Lake Pepin in under 2 years, and on some of the border waters it might be 5 years to get to a pound. So just because of the growth rate variation, it's a lot more difficult to apply a statewide slot limit, bag limit. So we've tried to do that more on an individual lake basis and be as consistent and standard as we could nonetheless. There are some growth rate differences.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
Ingebretson, I disagree. And I'm going to present a proposal where we do have a minimum size. So we'll have a fuller discussion about that probably in the next week or so.
Thanks.
On this point.
Senator Chaudhry, we do have Vern Wagner in the audience today who would like to spend a moment at the witness table. So
that would be good. And then we do have, I don't know if we're going to get to that amendment today.
We can get to it in another hearing.
Oh, yeah, we'll do that.
What your intent is.
Yeah. Senator Frederickson, are you okay with doing your bill first thing tomorrow?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I am.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Wagner, please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairperson, committee members, my name is Vern Wagner. I live in Minneapolis, and I'm a fishing guy. I write a lot of articles and talk to a lot of people about fishing and try to keep my finger on the pulse. And I'm here today to say that myself and many others are opposed to this four-fish reduction. This is a 33% reduction. And we don't think that this is the best time when Minnesota is already seeing a decline in fishing license sales, and we're seeing that fishing is going down the list on tourism, revenue from tourism. We're not sure that this is a good time to be sending the message that there's a problem with our walleye fishery here in Minnesota. There are only 17 lakes in Minnesota that currently have a four-fish walleye bag limit. And I got that figure by reviewing the 2008 fishing regulations and looking at the special regs. About an equal number of those lakes have some sort of slot limit or minimum size limit. But we're concerned that dumbing the limit down to four because of these 17 lakes, what about the other 10,000 lakes and hundreds of miles of fishable rivers and streams? If there was a biological imperative to do this, if there was a study that came out of the DNR that said, we need to do this for these reasons. But they're testifying that there is no biological imperative. So we think it sends the wrong message. We believe that it may have the reverse effect on harvesting fish. That if I have my mom and dad over for a walleye dinner, I can take 6 pound and a half, 2 pound fish, mm-hmm. and feed them. of course, if my brother shows up, I'm in trouble, but because he'll eat them all himself. But the thing is, if I now can only have four fish in possession, I am going to have to try to harvest the largest fish I can find in order to have a meal. So I think we need to be really careful when we reduce something by 33% and look at the consequences. I think this will affect families and young people. If you say we need to do something because it's a conservation ethic, well, that sounds like a really good idea. I think most people are for conservation. But I'm not sure that this is what we need to do to conserve and revitalize fishing in Minnesota. I think we should be coming up with ideas that make walleye fishing more attractive to people coming to Minnesota rather than less attractive. So I'd be willing to debate this issue, but yes.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of interest then, or a question maybe. With the licensing decline, would it be fair to say that it's because the fish population might be declining and maybe this is one way to address that? Or you certainly wouldn't argue with the fact that if once you get to your fourth decent fish, you're going to stop fishing, you're not going to wound any more fish. The two different fish. If I were to say you were to catch four fish right away, and normally you would keep going until six, you're going to save two fish, conserve on two fish. Do you think that would help the population at all by not taking those two?
Mr. Wagner.
I don't know the.
I think, first of all, if you can only keep four, you're going to keep fishing and releasing fish. Until you can get the four largest ones you can. And so you're going to lose a certain amount of fish through hook mortality that you normally wouldn't. If I gut hook a pound and a half walleye, I'm stuck with it, because it's going to die. I don't know if it's going to have that effect. Now, the decline in fishing license, it's a big subject that gets a lot of debate, and it's probably because we're losing youth and families to fishing. My family used to go on fishing weekends with grandparents, aunts, and uncles, and we would stay at a resort or a campground, and we'd go out and catch a lot of fish. And that's not an activity that's occurring with the same frequency.
Right.
And I think this type of reduction, a 33% reduction, is going to even discourage that type of thing.
Other questions for Mr. Wagner? Thank you for your testimony. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple issues that I'd like to raise back in the bill after thinking about it a little. And the first one is on page one, shelter, the definition of shelter.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fredrickson, before you
Senator
go into
Chandra.
That, may I offer a couple comments on this same, while we're
sure.
on the topic
yeah.
of four walleye? I spent, 2 years ago, I spent about $1,200 to drive 8 hours to Winnipeg and then fly another hour into Canada, into a fishing camp, to fish for 7 days. And the only fish I was allowed to keep were the ones that I ate on shore that day. And that amounted to about four per person. We had two or three people in the boat. We each boat came back with 8 or 9 walleyes of eating size. We were not allowed to take one fish back, not even a trophy. And yet I spent $1,200 and over a week of my time and gasoline and licenses and all the other spending to go and do that. I want people to spend their thousands of dollars to fly into Minnesota and fish instead of Canada. I think increasing the population of our walleyes will not hurt fishing. It will improve it. And I think that's what these lakes that have a 4-fish limit have seen. In combination with a slot, by the way, and a 4-fish limit, the ones that I have talked to on those lakes, Lake of the Woods, Mille Lacs, have seen a great improvement in their fishing. And that's why we now have over 300 lakes with special regulations on them. Because it's becoming more and more popular to catch larger and larger fish. And I think a lot of anglers agree with that. The Outdoor News is distributed statewide. It did a poll. 63% of the respondents favored reducing the limit from 6 to 4. And remember, this is a rule we've had since the 1950s. And our culture has changed. Maybe it hasn't changed completely for many anglers. And I think that's something I've really learned from the debate over some of these fishing regs over the last few months, and that not all anglers are alike. But I think we've come to a time in our society where 8 fillets per person per day is enough. That's my feelings. Mr. Wagner has different feelings, and I certainly respect them. But I challenge the notion that someone buys a license, buys bait, spends the gas, and maybe even a boat to go and fish to feed their family. I think it happens. I'm not going to say it doesn't. But even if you do, I think 8 fillets per person per day is enough.
Ag Committee is on our doorstep, Senator Chaudhry. So, Senator Frederick.
Oh, Senator Frederick, sorry.
Did you have some technical changes?
Well, Mr. Chairman, a couple things I wanted to discuss, and I don't know where this bill is going from here. I perhaps could do it at a later committee.
I don't think so, is it?
I think if you've got something that can move rather quickly, we'd hear it now.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Bogus, the first one I have is on page 1, the definition of shelter. I'm wondering if the way that shelter is now defined, if that would also also include a motor vehicle. Motor vehicle, a structure?
Mr. Chair and Senator Frederickson, that was not our intent. but could be open to that interpretation, I suppose.
Chairman, I don't have any amendments to that. It's just an issue I'm going to raise that you might want to look at further. Okay. The other is something I do have a little stronger opinion about. That's going back to Section 11, page 7, where we'll now be requiring a non-resident who owns agricultural land, require them to buy a license. Now, if they own 80 acres of agricultural land now and out in farm country, they could be paying anywhere. It's non-homesteaded just by definition. They're going to be paying anywhere from probably $30 to $50 an acre property tax, and then helping pay for any bond referendums for schools that come up besides that. And then we're going to charge them for a non-resident deer hunting license too. I think that's a little bit. I guess I prefer the law as it is now, that we would issue them a license without a fee, particularly if you look at paragraph B, that if they do receive a license for no fee, they have to open the land up for hunting.
Mr. Chair and Senator Frederickson, I guess we don't have strong feelings either way. Up until last fall, they could not get one of these licenses because there was a requirement in the law up until the 2007 session that they had to live on the land, and that live-on provision was eliminated. And we thought the intent was to continue to only allow it for residents, but if it's the will of the legislature that it's not, then I guess we don't have – there aren't that many of them that we're talking about here. I guess we don't have strong feelings. The question came up after the session, and we thought it needed to be clarified.
Mr.
Senator Frederickson.
Chairman, what sways me to leave it as existing law is that paragraph B, that if they do take advantage of this, the land's going to be open to public hunting. Senator Chaudhry, do you have a
– Senator Chaudhry?
Yeah, I didn't have strong feelings either way on that either.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senator to Federer, delete Section 11 from the bill.
We have a motion on the table to delete Section 11. Members, you'll find it on page 7. All of Section 11, Senator?
Yes.
All of Section 11, 7.1 through 7.18.
Sure.
Mr. Bogus.
Sorry to extend this, but there's a section of statute that says a non-resident may not obtain a license to do something unless it's explicitly authorized for a non-resident. So I'm just wondering, for this to be clear in the future, if we should just if we could look at, rather than deleting this section, maybe to a resident or a non-resident or something that makes it clear that other statute does not preclude this.
Mr. Knopf, can you help us?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a good suggestion. As Mr. Bogus points out, the current use of the current law where it says a person, I think if you read the other statute Mr. Bogus is talking about, it clearly would say that a non-resident isn't eligible for this license. So by saying a resident or a non-resident, you do clarify, because it does say in the Game and Fish laws that if it's not expressly stated that it's for a non-resident, that a non-resident is not eligible.
So in 7.4, we should include a non-resident?
Mr. Chairman, on 7.4, after the new term resident, insert or non-resident.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that amendment.
Senator Frederickson moves the amendment to add or non-resident after the word resident on line 7.4 to that amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Mr. Chair, we have another amendment that is kind of the size of a bill, so let's lay this bill over and we'll take it up and we'll discuss that amendment to this bill either tomorrow or another hearing.
Senate file 3425 is laid over and we are adjourned for the day.
Big one, thank you.